Donnelly College is a small Catholic school on a busy stretch of 18th Street in Kansas City, Kansas. It's made up of a handful of buildings on the grounds of an old hospital. When the college opened in 1949, it was focused on helping the children of Eastern European immigrants become the first members of their communities to go to college. First-generation college students still make up more than 90% of Donnelly's student body. It's just that now they're mostly Latino, like Jorge Dominguez, an aspiring civil engineer in his third year. He recently told us the story of his education.
I was in Mexico until I was 13 years old. Then I moved here. I had some personal problems with the family that I live with, and so I had to move out. When I first got here when I was 13, I did roofing when I was 13. But then after 2 years, when I turned 15, my uncle decided to take me to high school, and I started high school at the age of 16. I was always smart during high school. I was an honor roll student. I was a valedictorian. I also graduated with honors, and the school wasn't that hard for me. I didn't feel like I have a purpose of what I was. I didn't have an idea of what to do in life. But slowly I started to notice that I really like math, and civil engineering is something that I would really like to do. As a kid, I always played with Legos, or I like building things. I wanted to know how things worked. My teacher from high school, Mr. Turner, he taught me about reverse engineering and how people just work with any gadget and just break it apart and just to see what's in there and how it works. And that's why I also joined the robotics teams during high school. After high school, I graduated in 2011. I stopped going to school for 2 years since I live on my own and I don't have any family members. I had to fend for myself, and I never thought I would make it. But my vice principal from high school, Dr. Malcolm, he's a really good person, and he found someone who was willing to pay for my tuition. And I was really shocked by it, and I didn't believe it at first. But I still don't know the person. I'm really thankful for her. And throughout this years, I've been working hard to get straight A's, and I felt like giving up on school many times, but I have really good friends. They have pushed me and told me to keep on moving forward. I have nothing to lose. Keep at it. And the person that she's paying for me, I want to make sure that she's getting her money's worth. And I want to make sure I make my mom proud, the people that believe in me proud, and make something of myself, like make myself proud. Because there are some moments where I feel like I feel disappointed, but when I stop and look at things, I know, I look at where I'm at, and I never imagined myself being here.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll hear from first-generation college students like Jorge to get a better understanding of what it takes for them to make it to a college campus and why someone like Jorge might be tempted to give up on school along the way. I'd like to start by turning to Steph Hart and Eric Grosspitch. Steph is a counselor at Cristo Rey High School here in Kansas City. Her goal is to get teenagers into universities. And Eric is with us from UMKC, where he helps first-generation students clear hurdles once they arrive. Steph Hart of Cristo Rey, good morning.
Good morning.
And Eric Grosspitch, Dean of Students at UMKC, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Steph, tell me about Cristo Rey. What's the underlying idea of the school?
So we are a part of a network of high schools across the country. There are currently 30 Cristo Rey schools open. The shared premise is that all of our students work for a portion of their school tuition, and then the rest of that tuition is on a sliding scale. So we have students who are, you know, at DST and Garmin and Country Club Bank and some very well-known areas, as well as some schools and hospitals around the Kansas City area. All of our students have to meet an income threshold, and most of our students are free and reduced lunch and first generation.
When you say meet an income threshold, can you explain what that means?
Sure. Through the application process, they submit financial documents just as they would as they are applying for colleges. And with rare exception, most of our students are coming from low-income families, and their families are wanting them to have more than what's available to them in the public school system. They want them to have that work experience and an expectation of college.
Now, you have worked as a college counselor in other kinds of academic environments.
Correct.
Why did you make the move to Cristo Rey?
Cristo Rey had been open for several years before I came to work there, and I was always aware of what their purpose was, and I actually applied for a different job within our school, and then this one happened to be open, which was the better fit for me anyway. But in my previous lives, on all the other sides of the desk in college admissions, students were either already in college or they were going to college with or without me. And I felt like there really was this calling to a school like Cristo Rey, where they really needed somebody who had a deep understanding of the college and financial aid process to guide them through.
And you yourself are a first-generation college student in your own family. How does that shape the way you approach this work?
Every day. Every day I remember, I'm a crier.
No, it's okay.
Every day I remember the struggle my mom and I had when she didn't understand the college application process. I would be very frustrated with her. She'd be upset that she couldn't help me. I very definitely relied on the staff, not only at my high school, but at the college I ended up enrolling in the first place for undergrad.
What are some of the unique challenges that you, as a younger person, and now the students you work with, face as they begin to imagine the possibility of heading to college? I mean, where are some of the common points along the way where someone might get really discouraged or end up making another choice?
For a lot of the students at our school and first-generation students in Kansas City overall, it is clear that they have very supportive families, and they often have a very supportive church community as well. But similar to my mom, there is no background knowledge or experience of, when I was in college, this is how I did it. So parents are sometimes kind of hands-off simply because they don't understand. A lot of times, especially within our school, we also have a language barrier. So, we have a heavily Hispanic population, and sometimes our parents don't speak any English. And so we have people within our building who can certainly communicate. But oftentimes, that translation, the understanding of the college process itself, plus the translation and being able to explain that to a parent, falls on the student. And that can be really hard for some of our students who feel that burden. We also have situations where, a lot of our Spanish-speaking students, especially if they're the oldest or a female, they are responsible for translation in their family. And so they feel that their options are limited because they need to go to school somewhere close. And we are very lucky.
Oh, because their families rely so heavily on them.
Exactly. Yeah, for all kinds of things, medical translation, younger siblings explaining how to enroll in school.
Why does being female affect that?
It's just something we've noticed a lot of. I think just as a female, you tend to feel responsible for a family. And so we have our valedictorian from last year was male, and he stayed local for the very same reason. But he was our first male valedictorian at our school. So it just stands out to me more that our female Hispanic students specifically feel a real calling to be the translator and the main mouthpiece for their families.
I would imagine that in addition to having unique challenges, a lot of the students we're talking about would also have a unique source of motivation, or maybe kind of motivation, when it comes to applying for college. Can you talk about that?
Sure. As I was listening to our call-in, the whole idea of making a family proud, I hear that every day from our students. More so that they want to make someone else proud than themselves. Their motivation for success is to make a parent proud, to do things differently than their parents have, to have options that their families don't currently have. So that really is a underlying drive for a lot of our students across the board, that they feel the need to make someone else proud.
What are some of the programs that you offer at Cristo Rey, given that your school is specifically set up to help this exact category of student? What kinds of programs do you offer that other schools that might be overlooked at other schools?
So I think the thing that stands out the most for us would be our seminar program. And right now, even within the Cristo Rey network, we are the only school that offers seminar at all four grade levels. It is a required course. It's 2 days a week, and it's part of their GPA. And the whole purpose of seminar is college planning, starting with that freshman year. We spend a lot of time focused on academic vocabulary, learning the nuances of your GPA, what happens when you don't turn in an assignment, what happens when you fail a final, what happens if you fail a class, how does that hurt your opportunities for later. Sophomore year is a lot of study skills, career exploration. What are you interested in? What are you good at? What majors might link up with that? And then we spend a lot of time during junior and senior year focused on the specifics of college, writing an essay, writing their resume, creating a list of good fit schools, submitting their applications for admission, scholarship, and financial aid.
Talk to me about retention in the program.
Within our school?
Yeah.
So that's something that is a goal for us all the time, to be increasing that. And that's not just at our school, that's network wide. We certainly have a student body that changes from freshman year to senior year. Our school is not for everybody. There are a lot of demands. School starts at 7:30 and ends at 3:45. They miss at least one day a week for work. And so if they play a sport or they're involved in any other activities or they have a job after school, it's a long day. And if they're being bused in and bused home on our buses, it's even longer. We have students who are starting their day at 5:45 in the morning waiting
wow.
for a bus, you know. So it's a long day for some of our students. So we certainly lose some people along the way. We also might lose some students who are really not as committed to the academics as we would like them to be. And we hope that they will finish their diploma at another school.
What are there challenges that you find it's really hard to overcome, even for a school that's specifically setting out to serve the needs of first-generation college-bound kids? I mean, pressures that are on some of these kids that are simply too big for you to alleviate.
Absolutely. The day before Thanksgiving, one of our alumni showed up at school, unannounced, homeless. That stuff hurts, you know, and there were three of us who were still at school and, you know, sought out resources for her. So even as a high school graduate, currently enrolled in college, these kinds of hurdles still happen. It wasn't new for her. This was a challenge that she had faced all along through high school. And so we reinvested in her in explaining how different life can be when she finishes her program this summer, you know, how she'll be eligible for a higher paying job, that it's not in a fast food industry. So we do have families who end up with their utilities being turned off, and we help them as much as we can. We happen to have social services right next door to our building, so we have a good relationship with them. But our alumni, we have an alumni advisor. She reaches out to them, and I'm so grateful that our alumni still consider our school a home and a family and will return in times of crisis.
What are your hopes and fears as you do send a promising young kid carrying a family's hopes and dreams for a better future off to college?
My hope is they will do exactly what we intend of them, that they will find their new community in college, they will find their purpose in an academic major that will lead to a fulfilling career, and that they will be part of the system that gets their family out of poverty. My fear is that, and I watch this happen all the time, they feel the pressure is so great, and that when one wrong thing happens, they just can't do it and they throw their hands up. And that's where we come into play, to try to stop that from happening in the first place.
Eric Grosspitch, Dean of Students at UMKC, are those also your hopes and fears as first-generation college students arrive on campus?
Absolutely. It's that resiliency to be able to hit that first mistake or hit that first problem and be able to recover. So finding the connections and mentors on campus that they're finding at Cristo Rey to help them push through those moments and find those resources.
In the field of academic administration, which I think is what deans are in, what kinds of conversations are going on right now when it comes to the success of first-generation college students?
You know, I think anytime you try to classify a group of students, you've got to be cautious about that. But I think for many of these students, it is the exact things that Stephanie's been talking about. You know, they're worried about honoring somebody who's helped them get to this point. They put a lot of pressure on themselves. They're working a lot of hours to make this stuff happen. And so I think those are the normal. You throw into the mix there that they don't have the resource foundation to know where to go when something goes wrong.
Why not? I mean, how does that piece of information not get communicated.
Well, usually they're getting that from their parents, or they're from an aunt or an uncle or a sister who's been through the process. They're like, hey, go talk to financial aid, or go talk to admissions, or go talk to the registrar. They don't know where those next steps are. And so it's imperative of us through different programs and different outreaches to help them make those connections and know that they're not alone on campus, but they have those resources and people who care and want them to be successful.
Do you have a lot of direct contact with first-generation students as they move through their college experience?
It depends on the student, but yeah, I have a chance to work with a lot of students through the Block Scholars Program. Some of those students I'll come across. We've got our university college, which works with our deciding student process, and then with our coaching program. So it depends on the student, but do I have a chance to do that? Yes, I look forward to that part every day.
Do you find that a lot of students, I mean, you just mentioned that on the broader scheme of things, that a lot of students don't know how to access the kinds of programs you just described. Is that a problem at UMKC? Do you know of how many students aren't taking advantage of these programs?
Well, I think it's a problem nationally. So if you look at the parenting styles where mom and dad or grandparents have taken care of everything for the student, and then we bring them to college and say, hey, go ahead, you take care of it now. Even some of those skills of how do you advocate for yourself, how do you make sure that you're standing up and finding those resources is a learning process. And so we do start with that with many of our university one-on-one classes with University College to help students figure out this is your responsibility now. It's not your parents. It's not your providers to be able to help make that go forward.
What about this question that Steph was raising about just that sometimes particularly first-generation college students can run into one problem and feel that maybe this isn't meant to be, or this is just too big to tackle.
Yeah. So the university is putting in some processes called You Succeed, You First, which allows us from a faculty member's perspective, from a student perspective, to identify that student who's either starting to slow up, not coming to class, or is articulating to them that they've got a food issue or whatever else. And it allows us to put some of those safeguards into place. The worst thing that happens for us is when a student just stops and we don't know where they are or why, because we can't provide some resources. So below you here, we've got a food pantry that started last spring because we were really seeing those students who just didn't have enough to make the next piece. And if you can't meet Maslow's hierarchy of needs, food, shelter, you're not going to be able to move forward academically.
I understand that you yourself were a first-generation college student who wouldn't have recognized that label as applying to you when you were in college.
Sure. My dad went to college for a semester during the Vietnam era and then decided he wanted three squares a day. And so he joined the Navy. And so for me, it was still just learning, where do I go? And I found those mentors on campus who kind of took me under their wing and said, okay, this happened. Let's go talk to this person, or you need to go see this person. And it's finding those connections that are so critical.
Yeah, I'm curious how the school can identify students who need support and seek them out if students at 18 or however old maybe aren't in a position to do that for themselves.
And that's where some of the software, the You First, You Succeed, is coming in. So faculty members are noticing when a student either misses a couple of assignments, and they create an alert which lets an administrator, whether that be from the counseling center, an advisor, somebody like myself, to reach out and connect with that student. So we're a little being more intrusive in our advising process rather than just letting it happen, which is what we used to do. We used to just kind of let it happen, and now it's becoming a more intrusive environment.
We heard from Jose, the student at Donnelly College, mm-hmm. that he's been tempted more than once to give up on school. And this is a high school valedictorian we're talking about. Why might a first-generation college student, a really high-achieving one at that, be tempted to abandon the college path?
Well, the cost of higher education impacts them even more disproportionately than others. But it's also there is not that role model in their environment that says stick to it. So when I wanted to quit college, my dad said, no, you know, you're either going to do the service or you're going to do this. And so we ended up sticking through in those pieces. So it's that opportunity to really push that forward and have those folks who kind of have your back.
Are there crucial college experiences that first generation students are often just not in an equal kind of position to take advantage of?
Well, I think many of the study abroad environments, many of those pieces where this, we strongly encourage a student to get this international experience. Well, but if they're working 30 hours a week and they're trying to do those pieces and they don't have a family unit that's saying, yes, go to Spain, go to France, go do those things, it makes it a lot more difficult.
What is your perspective on that, Steph? I mean, do you follow students' progress and feel like, on the whole, the students who have graduated from Cristo Rey, who are first-generation college students, are getting the same kind of college experience that their peers are getting?
The big difference is in our students who are able to live on campus versus those who have to commute. I just met with one of our graduates recently who happens to go to UMKC, and she's really feeling the pressure at home because she's commuting, and her mom hasn't yet made the distinction between the student she was in high school and the student she is in college. She works outside of the home as well. She's responsible for the bills in her home. And so that pressure has increased now that she's an adult and still living in her home versus if she was living on campus. So that commuter piece is big. As a commuter student, whether you are a first generation or not, it is hard to be connected to a college campus. And if you already feel a disconnect somehow, whether it's because you're first generation or you're an ethnic or racial minority, whatever that might feel for a student, then you're going to go to class and you're going to go home and you're going to go to work and you're not going to have that feeling of connection to your college campus.
As tuition costs rise in the United States, I mean, we've talked about this in passing, but the burden of student debt often increases along with it. Do you worry about this shutting this particular population out of higher education?
Yeah, I think so. I think anytime the burden moves away from, you know, is it a public good or is it a private good, does put a lot more pressure on those students. And so I think the university has done a lot of different programs with the Advantage Grant and other things to try to narrow that gap. But it's still a very real gap for many of our students.
What about when I think about that transition from college into the professional world, a bigger and bigger part of that is often an unpaid internship. And I think of that as maybe a kind of thing that not everyone has equal access to. Is there something in place like at UMKC to help people access those kinds of opportunities maybe while they're still in school or... What can
sure.
be done about that?
So there's a couple of things. We do have a scholarship program, stipend program, actually, for students who are interested in doing internships in nonprofit organizations in Kansas City, to where while they may do a non-paid internship through the company or through the organization, there's actually a stipend that is given to them by the university. And so that happens. We've got a number of those that go on each year, and that just started last fall. So I think that's one area that we're trying to close that gap, as you said, to ensure that we can move that forward.
But what does that gap look like to you?
Oh, to me, I think the stipends tend to be about $800 a month, which is really may knock out some of those utilities and some of those other pieces. But it really is trying to find out what is our cost of attendance, what can that student be expected to give, and move forward from there.
Eric Grosspitch, thanks so much.
Thank you, ma'am.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from the students themselves, both a current student and a woman in her 30s looking back on her experience as the first in her family to go to college. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Good morning, everyone. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, and right now, high school seniors all over the country are stressing out about getting into college, and there is perhaps no greater pressure than the pressure on first-generation college-bound kids who are saddled with hopes and dreams, but who may not have the resources or guidance they need. We've heard from some educators. Let's turn now to the students. Inez Soto, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you for having me.
You go to UMKC, right?
Yes, I do. To the Block School. I'm a marketing major.
And you're in your sixth year?
Yes. Yes. It's been a long road, but I'm almost done.
Tell me about yourself and your background.
Well, I was born in Mexico, in the northeast of Mexico. And I moved here when I was in the fifth grade. So the experience of learning English and submerging myself into the American culture has been an incredible journey. Thankfully, both of my parents brought, the whole family here, and we have been lucky enough to, you know, to have opportunities that I have. And, you know, being the first female in both of my families to actually get an high school degree and now continuing into college, it's just so rewarding for myself and my family.
As a kid, when you imagined your future, what kinds of things did you picture? I mean, I know kids have sort of a funny idea about what adulthood is going to be like sometimes, mm-hmm. but what were your ideas?
Well, as a young child in Mexico, I always wanted to explore. I was very much, you know, like history and literature, and I always wanted to learn English. I listened to, you know, Britney Spears in Mexico, even though I didn't know what she was saying, but I loved listening to her. So I always knew that I wanted to, you know, go out from Mexico and explore new countries and new languages.
What did you think about college? Did you think about college?
No. I just wanted to, you know, finish high school, and because I wasn't really into school anyways, so I just wanted to get high school over with and then, you know, maybe just go to beauty school or do something else. But college was never on my mind until I went to Cristo Rey.
What happened specifically at Cristo Rey that got you thinking about college and maybe changed the way you pictured your future?
I think it was, you know, the influence that I had into, well, you know, you're in high school, this is a major accomplishment, but you still have, there's so many things that you can explore. There's so many things that you have to learn. And the corporate world, also, going into work, working with older people than me, it just made me realize that I needed to do better for myself and for my family.
Going all the way back to high school, mm-hmm. when it seems like this transition began for mm-hmm. you, have there been challenges? I mean, times when you haven't been sure if you can do it, if it's worth it, if it's the right direction?
Absolutely. I think every freshman has the doubts in the first semester. It's because, you know, you're adjusting your way yourself as a college student, learning as a college student, working, and you're kind of going into your 20s, so it's a different aspect of life. And I had doubts, and I cried to my mom, especially when I wasn't really passing math. I was like, Mom, I just can't do it. You know, like, there's no way that I'm going to pass these classes. But the support of my sister and my mother has been a huge influence in my college career.
You seem incredibly motivated. Where have you gotten your motivation? Can you talk to me about points along the way where something happened and it kind of gave you that kick to keep going and keep at it and stay on this path?
I think it was my mother and my father. They've been a huge influence in my life, and they're always going to be there for me. And I feel like my mom, you know, she's a very, very smart person, but she didn't have the tools to go to college. And that just showed me that, you know, I can do better for myself. And if she has trouble across the border, you know, to get her kids a better education, I should be able to reach that same goal.
Well, you've got one more year to go, as I understand mm-hmm. it. You're almost there. Can you believe it?
No, it's kind of surreal. It's surreal because I never thought I was going to be in this path of my life, but I'm also really thankful because I am here and I have other classmates who don't have the opportunity, but I do. And for some reason, I am supposed to be here in college, and I'm looking forward to see what else is going to be in my future.
Why don't some of your classmates have this opportunity?
I think it's different life paths that they have taken. You know, college is, it's like, I tell my mom, it's like a baby. You know, you have to nurse your school. You have to make sure that you wake up early to do your homework. So it's, and some people, and some of my classmates don't want to put that effort into, or, you know, don't have the chance to put the effort. So I think, and you know, college is not for everyone. I learned that in college, you know, you might not like college. You might rather do something else with your life, which is totally okay, you know. But it's just, I feel like personally, it's just the way that you want your life to go.
If you were the first person in your family to go to college or wanted to be or even just thought about it, mm-hmm. we want to know what gets left out of conversations like these from your perspective. What do administrators, faculty, and fellow students, maybe even politicians, need to understand about your situation? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Writer Sarah Smarsh is joining us now from Austin, Texas. She recently moved there from Kansas, where she, too, was first in her family to get a college degree. She now writes for major publications about class issues. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Dina.
We've heard a couple of immigrant stories, but that's not your background. Tell me about your upbringing.
Yeah, I was raised largely in rural Kansas, west of Wichita, in a pretty agricultural community. And as you noted, I write about class and in America, and that's often by way of my family's experience. So I was largely raised by my grandparents. My grandfather left school in sixth grade to work the wheat fields, and my grandma left in ninth grade. My parents, who also were involved in my life but were very young parents, left. Let's see, my mom got her GED. My dad did finish high school, but college definitely was not a discussion in my family and place of origin.
When did you start thinking about college?
Well, I think that I just kind of gleaned from my experience in the American public school system that was the next step in the sort of life that I envisioned for myself, which was a life that didn't necessitate manual labor. Which my family's lives certainly did. And I happened to be a good student, and school generally came pretty naturally to me. So I think that I just observed within the public school setting that the teachers and other kids would mention ideas like college. This is, came of age before the internet era, so I wasn't quite as steeped in kind of a global awareness as kids might be now. So it was probably in the classroom.
We're friends, so I know some things about you, including the huge amount of pressure you put on yourself from a really young age to not repeat the experiences of previous generations in your family, or at least certain aspects of those experiences. Can you explain what that pressure looked like and felt like for you as a teenager?
I think it would probably be best described as kind of making decisions. I don't want to say in a reactionary way, but in an almost intentionally oppositional way to my family's decisions. So much as I loved them, I saw kind of a template for the roads that they took for me as a young woman, say teenage pregnancy looming large as a potential life event that could derail me from my studies. So I had just kind of a constant awareness at a very young age of the distance between where I was and an adult self and life that I envisioned for myself, and that was going to be, that traversing that distance was going to mean also accepting that I would be kind of stepping away from my family in some ways. So that was a kind of painful consternation, but it was necessary.
And you went to KU. How did being a first-generation student set you apart in that environment? Did it?
It definitely did. My going to leaving for college in the 90s, I didn't. The term first generation, I think, probably was being thrown around in an administrative context then, but not nearly so pervasively as it is now. So I really had no word for or framework for or understanding of my place within the bigger picture. So I wasn't walking around thinking of myself as a first generation college student, though over the course of my studies and my time on campus, I certainly felt the distinctions between my experience and other kids. So I was working at least two jobs, sometimes up to four jobs, while also double majoring and taking like 18 hours a semester. And I, you know, at spring break, I would be working and my friends would be going to Cabo, or, you know, I definitely, I didn't know anyone else who was in my shoes class-wise, and that likely is because I was just a, sort of a minority in that way on campus. But, you know, in terms of at the individual level, I lacked a certain vocabulary for understanding ideas that would get thrown around. I often tell people that even though I ended up going to graduate school, I still didn't quite understand what the difference was between the terms undergraduate and graduate by the time I was even a college senior, because where I'm from, the word college is just kind of like this amorphous place with no distinctions. Also, you know, I remember feeling a little bit of a chip on my shoulder, actually, in classroom settings in particular. Professors, I remember often making offhanded comments about, kind of chiding comments about assuming that students' parents were paying their ways, and mine certainly were not, and they could not. I was there on by way of scholarships and work. And it would just, I got a sense when these jokes would get made, like, you better study for this test because your parents would be mad. They're spending their hard-earned money on an experience you're blowing off if you don't. It's like I was piecing together the reality that my college life was very different than the stereotypical one.
Ines, you are nodding. Is this something you can relate to?
Absolutely. And I think it's more in the educational, because I see, you know, like for me, it takes me a lot more to, you know, to get a certain class. You know, I don't really feel the difference between, you know, like your parents paying off, you know, this and that, because my parents helped me the little bit they can financially. But I see the difference between, you know, my education and then other, you know, students that maybe their parents have gone to college and they're a little bit more, like, I feel like they're more advanced than me, and I have to work like really like double to get to that, you know, to that grade, or, you know, to understand the concept.
Sarah, were there ever pressures on you that made you consider taking a break or possibly dropping out, or was that never a question?
For me, it was never a question for whatever reason. That isn't to say that, you know, that the process wasn't harrowing in a lot of ways. I think that, you know, my best example of a moment where I just kind of couldn't really take it anymore, I didn't consider dropping out, but I did, you know, I was a very dedicated student in high school. I worked to get good grades to get to college, and then once I got to college, I was kind of obsessed with keep straight A's to keep my scholarships and also to get a good job down the road. So I was kind of over-involved, I guess, in extracurricular commitments, and when my senior year, I just had was so tired and overworked that... Oh, are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. My senior year, I had a great position at the student newspaper at KU, and I ended up kind of mid-semester quitting that job because my schedule was not sustainable. And so I see that as a moment where I didn't kind of consider giving up on the whole process, but I did probably because of my situation was overworked and had to step away from something that a kid in another context wouldn't have. And I took that as a personal failure that I was really ashamed of.
You mentioned that you went on to pursue a graduate degree. Between undergraduate and graduate degrees, not to get too personal, but did you accrue a lot of student debt?
I did. At the undergraduate level, I ended up not borrowing much by way of scholarships and work. When I ended up getting into an Ivy League graduate school that for me represented just, I mean, it might as well have been, you know, like some sort of fantasy land that I just, it seemed so improbable that I would get in, and I sensed and had gleaned from cultural cues that this was some sort of ticket into a different kind of reality, and how could I not go. The financial aid package that was offered to me was pretty meager compared with the annual tuition, which was more than my parents' income combined. Not that their income was, really relevant to my life at that time. I was financially independent, but just to give you some context for how much money 40 grand a year is to a kid from a Kansas farm. So I had this moment where I had to decide, am I going to borrow the difference or am I not? I decided to, over the course of graduate school, took on an incredible amount of debt that was a real psychological and practical stress on me for many years.
Was it worth it?
For me, it was. And I can't say that, I wouldn't then extrapolate from that a recommendation for anyone that it would be worth it. For me, the risk paid off. And I'm glad I made the decision I did. These situations are so individual and complex that it certainly could have worked out to not have been.
Inez, is this something that you're going to face when you leave UMKC?
Yes, because I want to go to grad school. I want to further my education. But I do think about, especially because I've been debt-free for my undergraduate, so I'm really thankful for that. But, now that I'm moving to the next phase of my life, well, how am I going to pay for grad school? And,
and that's something you want to do?
Yes, grad school, yes. I'm looking for international business, but I definitely want to further my education as further as I can.
More to come on KCUR's Central Standard when we return your calls, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, and KCUR's Central Standard will be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. I've been chatting with writer Sarah Smarsh and UMKC student Inez Soto about their experiences as the first people in their families to pursue higher education. And now let's hear from a caller. We've got Philip in Midtown. Hi, Philip.
Hi there. I was the first in my family, but a couple of generations back. And the difference in the way that the higher education is treated and the public policies around it are astonishing. I went to UMKC, and if you adjusted for inflation what I paid, it would be probably less than a couple of $1,000 a semester. And student loans were at 3% at that time, and given you didn't start repaying, the interest didn't start running until after you got out of graduating. So we now, at the time, the state paid for 80% of higher education, and it now pays for 20%. That's a big difference in a shift in public policy that came in during basically coterminous with the Reagan administration. That's a big burden. And, frankly, if the federal government can loan money to banks at no interest, then it makes no sense that we are loaning money, we're allowing our students to be burdened by debt by requiring them to take loans at 6, 8, 10%.
So, Philip,
it's a public policy issue.
It sounds like it feels to you like this is a big difference between what you experienced a couple generations ago and what students are experiencing now.
It's a great difference, and one of the reasons for it was when I was in college, they'd gotten out of World War II, and the experiment with the GI Bill, they thought of higher education as important to the country, whereas now it's shifted so that it's only, this is something the students should bear. It's a very bad change in the way we view the value of an educated populace.
Thank you so much, Philip. Yeah, that shift from a communal benefit to the idea that it's more an individual benefit, therefore individual responsibility. I'd like to bring Steph Hart back into this conversation. She's a counselor at Cristo Rey High School here in Kansas City, where she offers support to a lot of first-generation students headed to college. Steph, working with one kid after another, is there something that you think could change, like in our system, to make things easier on these kids or to welcome them into the program of higher education just a little bit more?
I think there definitely needs to be an emphasis on the college campuses themselves about that transition. And we are starting to see colleges have, you know, semester-long orientation programs or a seminar class that they have to take as a freshman during that first semester to make that adjustment to college. But that also has to come back to the high school side. So like I said, we have our seminar program. We do some role-playing with scenarios that our students are facing, but not every high school student in high schools across this country have access to that. And so when they show up on the college campus and they haven't been prepared for how do you respond to X situation that we know our graduates have faced in the past, then they don't know how to handle that. When Eric was speaking earlier, I had an immediate reaction when he was talking about, you know, we offer all of these services and you asked about why aren't students taking advantage of them. And I think in a lot of cases, especially with first generation students, they take control over so much in their lives, whether it's the finances for their family or the translation like we were talking about before. But this is a foreign concept to them. And so they are less take charge about their education than they are about their day-to-day life in their home.
Because it's unfamiliar.
Exactly. Exactly.
Sarah Smarsh, you actually for a while were an instructor, a professor at the college level. Did your experience having been a first-generation college student within your own family affect how you interacted with students? Did you interact with first-generation students?
I did. The university where I was a professor, Washburn in Topeka, has a pretty large percentage of first-generation students and kind of working-class background. And I really relished interacting with that population and felt a real empathy with them for obvious reasons. The most direct way that that affected my approach to my job is that I became involved in a diversity initiative on campus, and one of my biggest contributions, I think, to that was always raising awareness of socioeconomic class in discussions about when we talk about the idea of diversity, alongside all of the other markers that are more familiar to us in that conversation. So, I myself, as a college student, actually benefited from a federal program that encouraged first-gen low-income students and minority students into graduate school and the academy. So that's just to kind of underscore earlier points that have been made about the relationship between public investment and the personal experience is something that by the time I was an adult professor, I understood and looked at very intentionally.
Steph, you know, I wonder a little bit about how soon preparation for college has to begin. If you want people, especially people who don't have sort of messages coming from their families about college, like how early, how young?
As early as possible, because it's not just about the college application process. It's about academic preparedness. It's about understanding what higher education means. Several years ago, Secretary Arne Duncan was in town, and I took a group of students to see him. And he talked about within the Hispanic population that students who learn Spanish at home and then go to school and start kindergarten tend to be about 5,000 words behind their peers who are speaking English in their home. And just to think that in kindergarten, a student is already that far behind and what they need to do to catch up academically, just in their day-to-day vocabulary, much less math and science and history and life skills, not just academics.
Inez, you are currently in your college experience. Mm-hmm. Help us picture a day in the life of this one first-generation college student. What's the rest of your day look like today?
Well, I have to go study for finals, and then I just go to school normally. I go drop off my sister to work. Then I go to school, stay up to in the library up to like 8:30, and then go home. I found a job that I can only work on the weekends, so I have the rest of Monday through Friday for myself. So it's not that really special, but it's something special for me. And it's going to be almost done, so I'm happy for it.
Well, congratulations. It's been really great meeting you, and good luck to you, Inez Soto.
Thank you.
Cristo Rey graduate and current UMKC student, as you look forward to your next steps.
thank you for having me, and I'm really, and I hope that I'm inspired for, you know, inspiration for other people, not only first college, you know, generation students, but also people that, you know, are trying to go back to school. It's hard, but you can do it, and education is very, very important.
Thank you so much for that message. Sarah Smarsh, writer with us from Austin, Kansas, misses you, but all the best to you in Texas.
Thank you, and congrats, Inez.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Steph Hart of Cristo Rey, thank you so much.
Thank you, and I just want to echo how proud we are.
Oh,
you can listen. Crying again.
Yeah, listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's also where you can sign up for our podcast, making it easy to listen on your own time. Tomorrow, join us to hear what stood out to local poets about Kansas City in 2015. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to Kyle Palmer. I'm Gina Kaufman, signing off.